Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Syndicated News, and I'm Raymond F. Rivas, Chief Financial Editor for syndicatednews.net. My firm is Atherton Wealth Planning. Broker-dealer is LPL Financial, and we offer money management and estate planning. And you may email me at raymondrivas@syndicatednews.net. And we are brought to you this evening by Atherton Wealth Planning. And my special guest is Mr. Robert A. Bjorn, attorney at law. I've known Bob Bjorn for about 25 years. And in our community here in the Palo Alto area, he's considered to be one of the finest attorneys in the California area, especially his estate planning. And he deals with anywhere from the ordinary individual to families that are extremely wealthy. And he's coveted by most of the by most of the law firms in this area. And tonight, my special guest again is Mr. Robert Bjorn. Bob, are you there?
I'm here, Raymond. Good evening.
Good evening to you, too. Bob, tell me a little bit about yourself and give me a little description as to your legal practice here in Palo Alto.
Well, Raymond, next month, on December 20th, I celebrate my 40th year of practicing law in Palo Alto. On December 20th, 1968, I joined what's known as the Chris firm in Palo Alto, which at that time was the largest firm in Palo Alto. But of course, as Santa Clara Valley became Silicon Valley, larger firms developed in the area, and we're far from the largest firm in the area at this time. We've stayed with our smaller, low profile, and I think I'm happy for it. But in any event, I've enjoyed practicing law in Palo Alto for quite a while now.
Yeah, since I've known you, you've always loved to be an attorney. And when we speak, you say, you've told me several times that, you know, you're going to continue being an attorney for a long, long time. So what makes the law so much fun for you?
Oh, Raymond, I think that, first of all, get to meet and interact with an awful lot of nice people, especially in my type of practice. I'm meeting with quality human beings with new and fresh ideas and questions all the time. And I have to say I enjoy that thoroughly. I've noticed you talked about continuing to practice. Heavens, I hate to admit it. I tend to get a little bored on the weekends. My wife tells me that I need a good hobby, and frankly, I enjoyed this one as much as any.
Well, I think when you and I speak, I think we just love what we both do in our own professions. Now, when you you've been practicing for a long period of time, and yet there's lots of lawyers that you know who prepare estate plans. Clearly, some estate plans are put together better than others. Bob, how can you tell when it's a good estate plan has been put together for a family as opposed to a bad one?
Well, obviously, Raymond, there's different levels of estate planning. But for the basic estate plan, which is I would call a modern-day simple will, consisting of a living trust and related documents, basically, there are several sources you can check. I mean, many lawyers advertise themselves today as specializing in the estate plan area. I think that's actually a good hint. I mean, if somebody holds himself out as a specialist in the area, at least he thinks he's pretty good, and at least he's trying to make an effort to be a solid estate planning attorney. Palo Alto enjoys a wealth of estate planning attorneys. Obviously, there's a considerable market for us, seemingly endless. I don't know, maybe we've come to the end at this time, but certainly in the past, seemingly endless market. I think the final thing, Raymond, is I would ask him. I would ask him if this is the kind of work he does on a regular basis. I would ask him how much experience he has in the area. And I think those would be two important questions, and I think any decent soul is going to give a straight answer in that regard.
What do you think about some of these firms that come around and have these seminars, and they charge $200 or $300 for a living trust or a will? What do you think of those? Do you have any thoughts on those kind of companies?
Well, to me, Raymond, it's a more personal thing. I think one thing you want to do, let's face it, having a solid basic estate plan is not exactly rocket science. A lot of estate planning is. A lot of estate planning is extremely complicated, and there's a lot of types of estate planning that I won't do, that I refer out to other attorneys that have particular specialties in those areas. But for a basic estate plan, I think the important thing is get it done right and to spend a few dollars, and I'm not even talking about an awful lot. I'm talking about a fourth of the price of what I just paid to have my house painted. You can have a good, solid estate plan done by an attorney that knows what he's doing, and I think that's important to do because the problems occur with estate plans that have not been prepared properly, and those problems compound the expense and the headache down the line.
I think that before we discuss some advanced estate planning strategies, Bob, when I'm able to make out that there are probably three federal tax systems whereby there's three different kinds of taxes. First of all, there's the estate tax, the gift tax, and the generation skipping tax. Let's talk a little bit about the federal gift tax first. What exactly is the federal gift tax?
Well, the federal gift tax is this, Raymond. Every individual is entitled to give $12,000 per donee per year to as many people as they can or wish to do so. $12,000 is, for all intents and purposes, exempted from the gift tax. You don't have to worry about it so long as you don't give more than $12,000 to any one person. But once you exceed a $12,000 gift in any one year to any one person, you then have what is referred to as a taxable gift. During your lifetime, and let me go back, $12,000 amount is every year. But once you exceed that in any given year, you have a taxable gift. There is a $1 million lifetime exemption against taxable gifts. In other words, if I were to, let's say I made a gift of $100,000 to my son, $12,000 of that would be covered by the annual exclusion. The remaining $88,000, however, would be a taxable gift, and I would use $88,000 of my $1 million gift tax exemption to cover that gift. It would only be after I had made more than $1 million of those taxable gifts that I would actually have to pay a gift tax.
Well, it seemed like a lot goes into that. I thought you said it was simple, Bob. More complicated.
I hope I didn't make it sound too. Maybe I just am a little jaded from the standpoint of doing it every day. But
it's easy.
I think one more element, Raymond, is to understand that there is really not a separate gift tax and a separate estate tax. There is one tax. It's called a unified transfer tax.
Mm-hmm.
When you create a taxable situation during lifetime, it's called a gift tax. But it counts against your estate tax exemption as well. Let me try to clarify that without getting too wound up here.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, everybody for 2008 is entitled to a $2 million exemption from the unified transfer tax. In other words, if I die and my estate does not exceed $2 million and I have not made taxable gifts during my lifetime, the tax to my heirs is zero. The first $2 million is exempt. Of that $2 million, I can use $1 million of it during my lifetime to cover those taxable gifts. So, to extend my example, let's say I died, I had a $2 million estate that I was passing to my heirs, but I had used $300,000 of that I had made $300,000 of taxable gifts, gifts in excess of my $12,000 annual exclusion. So I'd had to use $300,000 of my exclusion during my lifetime. Only $1.7 million, $2 million minus the $300,000 of lifetime taxable gifts. Only $1.7 million would be exempted, and I would have to pay tax on the $300,000, or my heirs would have to pay tax. No longer my problem.
Bob, what exactly is this federal estate tax?
The federal estate tax? Well, the federal estate tax, Raymond, has been around for since 1916. The United States has always been based upon the idea that what works best, in my mind, and there's some personal opinion coming into this, but the United States, I think, always recognized that what would not work for the betterment of the United States in the long run is to create an aristocracy. In other words, creation of a huge landed gentry with a huge, holding vast amounts of wealth. And the estate tax was incorporated in 1916 in order to break up the huge estates. It was always intended to apply only to the wealthy and to break up these larger estates and coincidentally get revenue for the government. Well, the problem is the exemptions didn't keep up with the growth and value of the assets of the people in the country. It was not indexed. And so more and more people started getting hit with the federal estate tax, people that were never really intended to be hit by this tax. Well, there's been a substantial increase. I remember when I started practicing law, the federal estate tax exemption was $60,000. Well, now it's $2 million. And as of January 1st, it will be $3.5 million. So bottom line, they're making some moves to exempt people who in this day and age would not be regarded as truly wealthy but simply well-off, trying to exempt those people from having to worry about the estate tax.
So after 2000,
I question in the process there, Raymond. But come on
and
back.
After 2009, in 2010, I understand that there is no estate tax, federal estate tax, in that year. But yet, when we were watching the Congress back about 8 or 9 years ago, they all kind of fled the congressional room and came. They were out saying that they had eliminated the estate tax completely. Is that true? Are they eliminating it completely?
It is true if the 2001 Act, yes and no, okay? In 2001, when George Bush became president, one of his stated goals was to eliminate the estate tax. In my view, well, never mind, I'm not going to go into politics, but in any event, so he wanted to eliminate the payment of the estate tax, which was not very popular with his pals down in Texas. And he attempted to do that, and several times during the past 7 years, bills have been passed through Congress, through the House of Representatives, rather, to actually eliminate the estate tax, but they've never been able to make it through the Senate, even though for a good period of that time, the Republicans controlled both the Senate and the House. So to make a long story short, Raymond, what happened was they came up with a compromise, and the compromise was that they would have increased amounts of estate tax exemption going through various amounts, starting at $1 million, going to $1.5 million. Right now, for 2008, it's $2 million. And as I said, starting January 1st, 2009, it will be $3.5 million. But then a funny thing happens. In 2010, they've got their wish. There is no tax. There is no
tax. That's good.
For people dying in year 2010. But then in 2011, the 2001 levels come back, and
well,
we
that's
have
not
the
good.
Estate tax back at exemption back at $1 million, and we have the rate, which is presently 45%, we have the estate tax rate going back up to 55%. So it's a what it does is it creates a very cloudy crystal ball for estate planners and for clients alike. And obviously, it's something that needs to be dealt with. And I think every year I have predicted that the following spring they're going to actually do something to clean this situation up. And
you're very, very optimistic.
Well, I think that my optimism may be justified this coming spring. As you know, Barack Obama was elected president. He is not of the same mind with regard to taxation as President Bush was. I think he's going to be inclined to, or at least it's also, going to be a Democratic House of Representatives and a Democratic Senate-controlled Senate. But I don't think that's, from a tax standpoint, for people who are paying taxes, I don't think it's all bad. I think we're going to get some clarity as to what the situation is, and I think the smart money at this point is betting upon a freezing of the estate tax exemption level at $3.5 million. And a reduction of the rate to 45% instead of going back up to 55%. So in other words, while that it seems kind of goofy as to what is happening in 2010 and 2011 under the present law, I think what they're going to do is they're going to freeze something pretty darn close to what we have starting January 1st, and that is 3.5 exemption with a 45% rate.
Do you think with all the problems we're having financially, you know, with the bailout of what, with $700 billion and General Motors wanting $50 billion, do you think that the Congress may face criticism if, in fact, because they perceive it as the rich, you know, these elimination of estate taxes in the year 2010 and 3.5 per person, husband for 3.5, the wife for 3.5, that means that for the first 7 million, that those folks are not going to have to pay any estate tax. But yet in our country, how many people are worth 7 million? So it does kind of beg the question, is there a favoritism to the rich? Or do you think that maybe they ought to make that even lower? Or do you think that's just about right?
Well, nobody's called me to ask me what I think. But
I'm calling you, Bob. I'm asking you.
I think the right thing, Raymond, is to have a tax that is defined so that we know what we're dealing with. I mean, this business of having the silliness that's in place right now with the future being absolutely uncertain, I think is not good. People are if they're going to have to pay taxes, they're entitled to plan accordingly and to work within the boundaries of the tax law on a fairly consistent basis. And the way we have it now, it's an undefined target, B, a probably moving target, and it makes it very difficult for people to make their plans around that. And I think that tax avoidance versus tax evasion, which is not good, but tax avoidance is a legitimate goal of the taxpayer. Everybody, I think, feels that they need to pay their fair share of taxes, but I think that they certainly don't want to pay a penny more. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, will you excuse me for a second, Bob? I'm going to go ahead and identify our radio station.
Sure.
This is Syndicated News. I am Raymond F. Rivas, Chief Financial Editor for SyndicatedNews.net. We are brought to you this evening by Atherton Wealth Planning. And now back to our special guest, Robert A. Bjorn, attorney at law extraordinaire. Bob, what happens? I want to go back to the gifting. Is it only limited to $12,000 per person? What happens if you make a direct payment to a hospital or a tuition?
Well, thank you. That is another exception. There are a couple of exceptions to what would otherwise be taxable gifts. Well, there's actually several that I can think of. In other words, obviously, if you give to charity, that's not a gift, taxable gift.
Mm-hmm.
If you give to your spouse, that is
mm-hmm.
not a taxable gift. I could give my, assuming I had it, which I don't, assuming I had $100 million and I wanted to make a $25 million gift to my wife, zero tax. I could make an unlimited gift of wealth to my spouse, which has many ramifications in the course of estate planning.
I'm sorry, Bob, did you say that you have $100 million?
No, I said I didn't have $100
million. Oh, you don't have $100 million. Oh, I said, my gosh, you're worth more than I thought, Bob.
Yeah. But in any event, Raymond, I think there's mm-hmm. a couple of more examples that exemptions that
mm-hmm.
need to be discussed, as you brought up. And number one, let's say that I choose to pay my grandson's tuition, and obviously that can be a lot of money today. And let's say that my grandson's tuition, room and board at expensive university amounts to $30,000 a year. Well, obviously that's more than $12,000 per year. So long as I pay the check, write the check directly to the university, not to my son to use for my grandson, but rather I write the check directly to the university, that is exempt from the gift tax as well. The second element of that, another exemption there, would be payment of medical expenses. But once again, medical expenses must be paid directly to the provider, cannot be paid to the individual who would then pay the medical expenses. As long as they're paid directly to the provider, once again, that's unlimited.
When we started this discussion, we said, or I said actually, that there are three different kinds of transfer taxes you have to be concerned with. One is the gift tax, the federal estate tax. What is this generation skip tax?
Well, Raymond, I'm a big fan of 8.5 by 14 yellow legal pads, because to me a picture is worth 1,000 words, in particular in this situation, and that's a much easier way to explain these topics. But let me try to do this in thin air, and that is this. What wealthy families discovered a long time ago was that, well, let me go back one step. The game plan for the estate tax is that assets are taxed at each generation. In other words, grandfather dies, leaves his estate to his son, there's imposed an estate tax to the extent that estate exceeds $2 million on today's limits. The son has what's left over. He dies, leaves it to his son, the grandson. Once again, those assets are taxed to the extent they exceed the $2 million exemption. Well, one thing wealthy people discovered a long time ago, that this doesn't work very well. And so what they did, they would set up trusts. In the simplest fashion, you'd set up a trust, typically referred to generically as a generation-skipping trust. In other words, I, as grandfather, would not give the money directly to my son, but rather I would put it into a trust that would provide that my son would be entitled to the income during his lifetime, but that upon his death, it would go to my grandson.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it wouldn't skip the tax in my estate. Too late. You have to look a generation ahead. But it would skip the tax in my son's estate. So it would skip that generation, that second generation of taxes. And this can obviously go out into trusts that go on and on and on through various generations, and or many generations. And wealthy families have been doing this for a long time. Well, Congress recognized that only extremely wealthy people, for the most part, are able to do this. And so they enacted a thing called the generation-skipping transfer tax. And what they said was, fine, you have skipped the generation of taxes at your son's death by setting up that generation-skipping trust, and that's fine and dandy. But if you do that, we're then going to impose a different tax called a generation-skipping transfer tax. And by the way, our exemption there is exactly the same. It's $2 million. So in other words, the generation skipping transfer tax, the generation skipping trust is still a viable estate planning tool to avoid taxation through multiple generations. But you have to be careful to make sure that you do not get outside the exemptions available to you with regard to the generation skipping transfer tax exemption. So it's just another element that needs to be looked at.
Mm. You know, there's so many variables. Bob, living trusts have been around since the creation of the United States. But I would say that I started recognizing living trust probably in the last, 20, 25 years, because for a long time, people just did not do living trust because the size of the estates were not that large. What exactly, how would you describe what a living trust is?
Well, I can tell you, Raymond, when I joined, let me just back up a second, because I agree with you that they haven't been in widespread use for all that long. When I started practicing law with the Criss firm in 1968, end of 1968, I mean, there was a whole department that did nothing but probate. In other words, people had wills, they died, and when they died, their estate had to go through a court-supervised administration called probate. Expensive. It was great for the attorney from the standpoint that there was a graduated percentage applied for attorney's fees and that sort of thing. And it was really quite a booming business. But along about that time, and in particular in the 70s, more and more people started using a living trust. Why? For several reasons. Number one, if you set up a living trust and you funded it with your assets by transferring your assets from your individual name to your name as trustee of your living trust, they didn't have to go through probate. They did not have to go through a court-supervised probate administration upon your death. That's a big deal. I doubt that any viewer listening to this program, I guess not a viewer but a listener, listening to this program, I'm sure they all have heard about living trusts and the fact that they avoid probate. But it goes beyond that, Raymond. Today many, many people are living longer, and later on in life, they're incapable of handling their own financial affairs. Well, in the old world, they would be stuck with a court-supervised conservatorship proceeding. And a court-supervised conservatorship proceeding, excuse me one second. A court-supervised conservatorship proceeding is like a probate, but it's for a living person.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's just like a probate, but the person is still living. It's just a court-supervised administration of their assets for their benefit. So that, if you think you want to avoid probate, Raymond, I would multiply that desire by 10, and that would be how much I'd want to avoid a conservatorship. And so that's the second, to me, even more important element of a living trust, and that it is avoids the need for a court-supervised conservatorship proceeding. Those are extremely expensive and painful. So that those are two elements right there. Furthermore, most people who have younger children are going to need to have a trust anyway for the benefit of their kids. If they don't have a will or a trust that provides that their assets are going to go into a trust to their children as opposed to outright to the child, they've got two problems. Number one, let's say your children are minors when you pass away.
Okay.
And you've done nothing. Well, the assets would have to be held for the benefit of the child in a court-supervised guardianship proceeding. And the worst thing about that guardianship proceeding is that it would terminate at age 18 for the child and distribute the assets outright to the child at age 18. Can you imagine a worse age to be giving a lot of money to a kid?
Not at 18, I'll tell
you. So they get the money at age 18, and it's gone when they're 18 and a half. And so what you want to do with a trust for the benefit of the child is defer the distribution to the child to a later age, 25, 30, 35, 40. You know, it depends
mm-hmm.
upon the child.
Mm-hmm.
And those trusts can be fairly flexible so that you can take in the trustee, the person you've named to take care of this money for your child, can have some flexibility with regard to making distributions for the child. If the child turns out to be a little smarter than you thought maybe he was.
Bob, I'm going to break in just for a moment or two. Hope you don't mind.
Not at
I'm
all.
Going to identify our radio station again. This is Syndicated News. I'm Raymond F. Ravis, Chief Financial Editor for SyndicatedNews.net. We are brought to you this evening by Atherton Wealth Planning. And you can email me or Bob at Rivas, that's R-I-V-A-S, at SyndicatedNews.net. And again, we're brought to you by Atherton Wealth Planning. And my special guest is the attorney, Mr. Robert A. Bjorn. Bob, besides the living trust, when someone leaves your office, and do you just provide them a living trust only, or do you give them other forms or other things besides the living trust itself?
Well, let me back up and mm-hmm. finish off the living trust first,
Frank, okay.
Because I don't ever think I ever said exactly what it is.
Okay.
And basically it's this. You, the person creating the living trust, execute a document which declares that you're holding the assets that are listed as assets of the trust in trust pursuant to the terms of the written document that you've created. Typically, the person creating the trust is also the trustee during his or her lifetime or until he or she is unable to manage the assets any further. In that document, you also name people to succeed you as trustee to take care of these assets in the event of your death or incapacity. You also make provision in the trust as to how the assets are to be distributed or maintained in continuing trust at the time of your death. And it's also the place to do some tax planning to, in particular, for example, we'll talk about later the husband and wife situation where you want to make sure that you capture the exemption of the first deceased spouse at his or her death.
Mm-hmm.
So the living trust is simply a written document that outlines these provisions. And as I say, the basic living trust that is the base of all estate planning opportunities is not a particularly complicated document. It simply needs to be done right. And you asked me earlier what I thought about trusts that were being done, say, at the seminar type thing, and you know, they may be fine. I don't know. I've seen some of those that are terrific. I've seen some that are terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that one thing I would like to discourage, and I hope people will believe me that I'm not looking for business. Believe me, I have a full plate as is.
You're a very successful attorney.
But what I'm about to say, Raymond, is that one thing I would like to discourage is self-help in this regard. It's too easy. It's not that difficult to do right if you know what it's like everything else. If you know what you're doing, it's not that difficult to do it right, but it sure is easy to screw it up if you don't know what you're doing. And if you do follow it up, you probably created more headaches than you had in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So while Nolo Press is, for example, puts out books on how to do your own legal work, while it might be terrific, a terrific way to get some background as to the topic, the legal topic that you're dealing with, I would really discourage having the ultimate document done by anybody other than an attorney that actually does this type of work and knows what they're doing and knows how to get it done right so that you have the peace of mind everything is going to be carried out just exactly
mm-hmm.
the way you want it done, at a minimum of expense in the long term.
Well, I think that's really good advice, Bob, because I've, in my practice, I have people coming in with living trusts and that they sometimes do themselves, and they don't have anything else in addition to that. And so they truly believe that the living trust is a do-all to do-all, and when they have large estates, they don't do any other planning. When you say, Well, what do you have? Well, they say, Raymond, we're really well taken care of. We've done everything we could possibly do, and this is my living trust. And so I said, well, what else do you have?
The end all. I mean, with I think your question was, what else goes along with a living trust? Well, you do still have a will.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the will really doesn't do much. All the will says is, if I, Bob Bjorn, die and I failed to put an asset into my living trust, please put it into my living trust at the time of my death for common administration with my other assets that are
mm-hmm.
in my living trust. It's called a pour-over will. You simply want your estate poured over into your living trust, and that's the place where the administration occurs. Well, as to those assets, with respect to those assets, you do have to have a probate administration. The way to avoid probate is to have the living trust and to get the assets transferred to the trust. How do you do that? It's tedious, but not that big a deal. Basically, with regard to real estate, you do a deed. In other words, I would transfer, I have a piece of property in my name, Bob Bjorn. I would transfer that, I'd do a deed, and I would transfer that from Bob Bjorn to Bob Bjorn as trustee of the Bob Bjorn Trust.
Okay.
And record that deed. With regard to my brokerage account at Schwab, I would go down to Schwab, fill out the paperwork, and make sure that that account was plated. Bob Bjorn is trustee of the Bob Bjorn Trust, dated so-and-so. So in any event, my point, Raymond, is that you do have a will, you just don't want to use it, and you want to have made these transfers to your trust during your lifetime while you're still alive. There is a backup document to that called a what I call a trust transfer, often called Schedule 8 of the trust, whereby you have a listing of assets that are to be in the trust.
Mm-hmm.
But that really is not in and of itself adequate in most cases. Certainly with regard to brokerage accounts, certainly with regard to real property, I would make sure that all of those assets are retitled into the name of the trust.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a third document, and all of these documents are designed to accomplish simplification, believe it or not. In other words, it's sort of counterintuitive. It looks like you're getting a bigger pile of paper, and you are getting a bigger pile of paper than a simple little will, but that simple little will is probably the most complicated document a person could have. All of these other pieces of paper, such as the will and the living trust, or the pour-over will and the living trust, are designed to simplify. And so the next document also simplifies, and that's called the power of attorney. In other words, if I were to establish a power of attorney, it would say, I, Bob Bjorn, hereby appoint Raymond Rivas to act as my attorney in fact, to act as my agent in the event that I'm unable to do so. And I hereby empower Raymond to do anything and everything, or limited powers, on my behalf. That, during my lifetime, allows Raymond to take care of me. So I become incompetent. Raymond, you lucky dog, you get to come in and take care of everything for me, yeah, under the terms of that power of attorney.
And I would move from Schwab over to LPL.
Yeah,
you forgot that part, Bob.
I didn't say the right thing. Right. Sorry,
Bob. How often should a person look at all of these instruments that you've spoken about the living trust? You talked about the durable power of attorney, and I'm sure you know the health and these various instruments.
And the healthcare power of attorney.
The healthcare power of attorney. How often do you want someone come into your office? I mean, there's nothing more than a protection, make sure everything is okay. Do you have them come in every 20 years, every 10 years, every 5 years, or how often would you recommend come in?
I think the standard rule of thumb is to check in every 5 years, absent some intervening change of circumstance, such as a family change, such as a change in health, such as a significant change in wealth. Obviously, there's a number of circumstances that would cause you to want to take another look at your estate plan. But there's no harm in giving your attorney a call every 5 years and saying, Bob, how's how do things look? And I get those calls all the time, and I will admit that for the past quite a few years, I said, gee, there's really not a lot of changes that have occurred. But for example, assuming I'm right in my optimism and that by May of 2009 they're going to enact some legislation that will, in fact, define what our estate tax law is, I'll put out a memo to all of my clients that say, here's what happened. Here's how it impacts your estate plan, and here's what you need to do. So when big events like that occur, you know, typically the when big events like that occur, typically the clients are notified, but it certainly doesn't hurt to call your attorney every 5 years and, dear Joe, you know, how does my estate plan look? Because we try to keep track of these things, but I, you know, it's, and we do put out little newsletters every now and then, but no, call and say hello.
Yeah, at least let you know that they're thinking about it, and they ought to be taking a look at these, all these instruments that you should buy every 5 years. Bob, every once in a while, I work with clients who have these LLCs and family limited partnerships, and they find these instruments very appealing. Why would someone use an LLC, limited liability company, or a family limited partnership? What are those instruments used for in the area of estate planning?
Well, I don't think they find the documents themselves so attractive, Raymond, but they do find the tax savings that can be achieved through the use of family limited partnerships or LLCs. They find that attractive, and that the desire to save those taxes allows them the impetus to go ahead and do all the work that's inherent in that kind of a document. So this is really the next level of estate planning over and above the basic level that I just described. So let's say that I have an office building, I wish. Let's say I had an office building worth $10 million. So obviously I'm well over the estate tax exemption, and I'd like that office building to stay in my family and not be encumbered with more estate tax, or I'd like to reduce the amount of estate tax that building's going to be hit with. What I would want to do would be to make gifts of portions of that building to my children. But on the other side of the coin, I want to maintain control over it because I happen to think that during my lifetime anyway, I want to maintain control over that asset. I want my kids to get a piece of it, and I want to reduce my estate tax liability, but I want to know that I've got control over that property and it's going to be there to take care of me the rest of my life as well. Charity begins at home, right?
Absolutely.
So in any event, what I'll do is I will probably initially, there's a variety of ways to approach it, but initially I might give off a little sliver of that building to each of my two children. Then my two children and I will join together and create a partnership. They'll contribute their sliver of the building, and I'll contribute my big chunk of the building, and we then own the building in the partnership, which owns the building, in the same proportions that we owned the property before. But what that affords me is the opportunity to then to do a couple of things. Number one, it affords me the opportunity to make future gifts of that building on a highly discounted basis, because my partnership agreement is going to provide for restrictions on transfer. It's going to provide for a game plan whereby the, at least arguably, the value of each percentage interest in the property is reduced, is discounted. And that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to discount the valuation of the asset in my hands. But at the same time, as I said, I want to maintain control, so I can do that as the general partner, for example, of the family limited partnership. But, and these are wonderful opportunities to get yourself to a position where you're able to provide discounts, and this can be a tremendous tax reducer in the larger style estate. But at the same time, I'm able to maintain control over that property. But there's the other rub of the thing. The one place that these cases tend to get in trouble, and I'm sure you've read cases, Raymond, where family or limited partnerships were ignored for estate tax purposes. In other words, they didn't work. The main reason they don't work is because they weren't executed correctly either. In other words, if you're going to have a family limited partnership, you have to pay attention and treat it just like any other partnership you'd have with other people. In other words, if I end up with, say, 70% of the partnership interest and my children each have 15% of the partnership interest, they must each get 15% of the income. I can't sit there and hog the whole 100% to myself, even though I might want that. I must conduct the partnership proceedings just as if I were dealing with independent third-party partners.
And Bob, is this the primary reason or the argument that the Internal Revenue Service uses in challenging the family limited partnership?
Those are the cases they win.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the cases that the service wins. And, you know, so I think that there's other ways to do it as well, Raymond. I think, for instance, with regard to real property, using tenancies in common can work as well. And then you have an overriding tenancy in common agreement among the owners of the property, whereby their ability to transfer these properties or their interest in the property is restricted, so that you there's some level of assurance and control maintained, even though assets are being transferred down to the next generation. And once again, you're setting yourself up for fractional share discounts. What do I mean by fractional share discounts? Well, in other words, let's say that I have a piece of property worth $1 million,
mm-hmm.
and I own 90% of that piece of property. Well, you might think that that 90% is worth $900,000, 90% of the $1 million. But what an estate planning lawyer does in dealing with the service in this case is argue that, well, really that 90% interest isn't worth 90% of the whole, because after all, could that person take his 90% interest and sell it out in the open marketplace for 90% of the full value? And the answer in all cases is, of course not. I could not take my 90% interest in that property and sell it to somebody for 90% of the whole, because why? They have to deal with the other 10%. And obviously our goal is to get lesser and lesser percent when we're trying to do wealth transfers from generation to generation. So in any event, given that I have a fractional share, we apply a discount, a marketplace-style discount, as to the valuation of that 90% interest. It might run from anywhere from 10, 15% to 35, 45, 60%. I mean, obviously, the more aggressive you get in that regard, the more inclined you're going to be looked at by the IRS.
Mm-hmm. You might be on the radar scope if you take too much.
Well, you might. And but the bottom line is, I mean, obviously the old saw that the pig gets fat and the hog gets slaughtered is applicable in all cases. But I think that bottom line is that there are sort of quasi-established standards in this regard, and there are guys, discount appraisers, that make an awfully good living. They specialize in this area, and they have all the cases at hand, and they provide solid arguments that are presented to the IRS. And I would say that in cases where the parties have put the documents and the partnership together properly, operated the partnership in accordance with normal partnership operating standards, and they haven't gotten greedy with regard to the discounts to be taken, that they work, and they don't, and they'll look and they'll say, well, gee, this one's not worth chasing. And they pretty much are going to let something that is reasonable go through. And there's one more level of discounting. If over a period of years I can continue to gift pieces of this partnership to my kids, my goal would be at some point to get to 49%. Then I have a minority interest, and now I can apply an additional level of discounting to my minority interest, get the minority interest discount, which is in addition to the fractional share discount. So now I've discounted it down even further. So
Bob, will you hold that thought for a moment. Let me get the identification of the radio station one more time. Bob, and the audience, I hope you're enjoying this. It's a true learning experience for an experienced attorney like Mr. Robert Bjorn. And again, this is Syndicated News, and I am Raymond F. Rivas, the Chief Financial Editor for SyndicatedNews.net. We are brought to you this evening by Atherton Wealth Planning. And now back to our special guest, entertaining and full of wisdom. And we're gonna this last 10 or 15 minutes we have left, we're going to try to see how we can wrap this up, so therefore you'll feel, my gosh, Bob is really a very talented fellow who I probably have to get a hold of.
Let's not worry about Bob.
You're located in Palo Alto.
That's right, Raymond.
Do you have a website?
Oh, we do, Raymond. I believe the website is csbslaw.com.
Say that one more time, so the radio listeners can write that down.
Charlie Sam, Bob Sam. And the last I saw last week, the website is being rehabbed right now, so I don't know if it's up or not as yet.
Okay.
But there is one up, but it's being redone at this time. So,
well, where
Bob Sam Law.
Where are you located specifically?
Downtown Palo Alto, Raymond.
And the address?
550 Hamilton Avenue.
And your telephone number?
Oh, Lordy. 650-321-5001.
Good.
I have to warn people, Raymond. I'm on vacation, so I won't be back in the office until next Thursday.
Okay, we'll do.
Santa Barbara right now.
If anybody gets hold of me or emails me, I will find your web page, and so therefore they can send you an email, or they can contact me in Palo Alto on Hamilton Avenue. I do want to kind of summarize some of the things that you have said, because it seems to me, Bob, that there is a philosophy of estate planning, and what we talk about when I've talked with a top attorney like yourself and some of the other attorneys I've spoken to. I find that in order to preserve these estates for families, like what you said tonight, you said that you want to go ahead and be able to give the client the flexibility to go ahead and do whatever has to be done in order for them to try to achieve whatever the estate plan they're trying to put together. And the relationships with the family itself is very important, and you craft your estate plan that you develop for them to meet those needs. And I'm also hearing that you also take a look at those taxes, whether it's gift taxes, federal estate tax, generation skipping is also something you take a good look at. And then what you also said was that you want to be sure that as an estate planner that you do whatever has to be done so that the money gets transferred to the next generation, and you play the game by the rules. And if you play the game by the rules, then it will turn out like the client hopes. And so the one area I also like to touch is, what do you think about life insurance? Do you use life insurance inside these estate plans from time to time?
Well, quite often, Raymond, oftentimes. For example, let's go back to my example of a $10 million business.
Mm-hmm.
It may appear that it's unlikely that you're going to be able to get that down to a zero tax, and so you can see that there's going to be some tax to be paid, but you want the kids to have that business. You don't want it to be encumbered with the estate tax. You don't want them to either lose it or have to do some kind of financing to keep that business. You want that family business to stay in the family. Well, So then how are you going to pay the estate tax? Well, a good way to do that is with life insurance because, as you well know, there are a couple of methods, I was going to say games, but let's call them methods, that you can use to create life insurance that's payable at your death but is not included in your taxable estate. So you don't have to pay tax estate tax on the life insurance. And it's important to note because oftentimes I find people thinking that life insurance is tax-free. Life insurance, yes, it is income tax-free to the beneficiary, but it is not estate tax-free unless you set it up right, typically in the first place. So that's important to remember, and that's a place where life insurance can be a great tool to provide the money to pay the estate tax so that the family business or the important piece of income production property, that sort of thing, is not lost or encumbered by the estate tax upon your demise.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the other place I think, of course, is, you know, I've never ascribed to the old theory that to be a responsible person, you have to have life insurance. I think that what you really need to do is determine what your need is and then to fill it. For example, let's say you're a young man with a large mortgage and kids going to college and you've got a lot of expenses and you can see that for the next 10 years, if something happens to you, your family has a problem and you want to insure against that. Well, obviously, there's a perfect place for a 10-term policy. Raymond, did I lose you?
No, I'm listening very carefully. I guess you have to take a look at each specific family, see what their needs really are. You sit down with them, Bob, and say, "Well, now look, I recommend that you use this kind of life insurance. This is that it's appropriate for you. You just don't recommend life insurance in general. It has to be well thought out. Has to see if it fits the plan." See if it's not if it's the least expensive that you can get to reach your goals, and it sounds to me that's basically what you do. Because I worked with you before, and that's kind of what you do. You're very careful about those kind of things. I can see we're starting to come to about. There's only about 2 or 3 minutes left, and I did want to hear your telephone number again, Bob, in case someone does want to get hold of you. I hope you don't mind if I ask you for that again.
All right. The office number is 650-321-5000.
And lastly, are people doing any estate planning in this god-awful environment that we have? I mean, are they coming to say, you know, this
well,
might be the perfect time?
Well, that's right, Raymond. Let's face it. Certainly one can argue that real estate values are not what they were a year ago or 3 years ago. But, you know, of course, the history of California is that we've had times like this before, and my guess is, my hope is, that in 5 years, we'll be back at it again, and these values are going to be back up there. So what better time to start thinking about making gifts of real estate and that sort of thing than right now when certainly you're the person doing your evaluations for you.
It's a great time to come and see you. It's a great time because the values are down. You know, like you said, they're going to bounce back up, maybe not all the way like they were previously, but now when the environment is, it's a good time to come and see you, Bob, because how often do you have these assets reduce in value? And I think it's only a temporary thing. You do the proper planning with you, Bob, and they'll be grateful to you for the rest of their lives. It'll make a huge difference for their children.
Well, certainly. I can remember back in the late 90s when stock prices were so high and people didn't want to sell them, didn't want to realize the capital gain, and so they did things like charitable remainder trust. I've had people come to me and say, "Bob, thank you so much for setting up that charitable remainder trust. I would have never sold that, would have never liquidated that stock but for that." So,
well, Bob, we have come to the end of our time, and boy, the hour just flew.
When you
and I spoke a couple of weeks ago, you said an hour. My gosh, it's going to be forever, but we're at the end, and we've only gotten started. Maybe the next time we can talk about offshore assets, and we can talk about twist accounts, but that's at another time. I want to thank you again, Bob. You've been a wonderful guest, and we're now completing our broadcast.
All right,
so again, this is Syndicated News. I'm Raymond F. Rivas, Chief Financial Editor. We are brought to you tonight by Atherton Wealth Planning, and our special guest was that very special person, Robert A. Bjorn, attorney at law in Palo Alto, California. Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome, Raymond. Good evening.
Good evening.